Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, May 30th, 2025, we are delighted to host a Courthouse Steps decision program on Seven County Infrastructure Coalition versus Eagle County, Colorado, which was decided yesterday by the court. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I'm an Associate Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. Now, in the interest of time, we will keep introductions of our guest day brief, certainly more brief than the careers would deserve, so I highly recommend that if you're interested, you check out their impressive full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Mario Loyola, who is a Senior Fellow for Law, Economics, and Technology at the Heritage Foundation. Professor Loyola formerly served as Associate Director for Regulatory Reform at the White House Council on Environmental Quality. In that role, he was one of the principal drafters of the One Federal Decision Policy, which aimed to streamline the permitting and environmental review of large infrastructure projects. While at CEQ, he was a member of the U.S. delegation to the USMCA free trade negotiations with Mexico and Canada, as well as the United Nations Conference on Biodiversity in the High Seas. Professor Loyola is a frequent contributor at the Wall Street Journal, National Review, and The Atlantic, among others. He teaches environmental administrative law at Florida International University, where he is the founding director of the Environmental Finance and Risk Management Program in FIU's Institute of Environment. Also joining us today as our moderator for today's conversation is Austin Lapari, who is counsel at Boyd & Gray, PLLC. Before joining the firm, he served as an advisor to the chairman and commissioner James Danley at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, assisting on critical infrastructure issues under both the Federal Power Act and National Gas Act. Ms. Lapari also formerly served at the Attorney General's Office of Legal Policy within the Department of Justice as senior counsel and on policy coordinating committees seeking to advance the implementation of regulatory reforms and protections of religious liberty and free speech. He's also held several roles in the Office of Personnel Management's Office of General Counsel, including the Deputy General Counsel, where he coordinated the review and development of numerous executive orders, regulations, and other significant policy vehicles. And I will leave it there. One last note, throughout the program, if you have any questions, please do submit those via the question and answer feature, likely found at the bottom of your Zoom screen, so they'll be accessible when we get to that portion of today's webinar. I'll ask that all questions submitted there, A, pertain to this discussion, and B, end with a question mark. With that, thank you all for joining us today. Mr. Lapari, the floor is yours.
Thank you. As we get into this, NEPA, as I'm sure most of our viewers appreciate, has come to be synonymous with red tape and delay in building, developing infrastructure across the United States. Endless years of environmental review then get handed on to the judicial branch, where project sponsors, project applicants find themselves playing roulette as to whether or not their project will survive judicial review when it is inevitably challenged by a constellation of environmental NGOs. So yesterday's decision was the first substantive NEPA decision out of the Supreme Court in almost 20 years. And as we'll discuss with Mario, it has the potential, it may have the potential to fundamentally change the NEPA landscape, or perhaps not. So we'll discuss how far-reaching this decision is, what it means for developing infrastructure in the United States, what it will mean for President Trump's energy dominance agenda, and where we'll be going from here. So to set the stage just a little bit, the course of decisions that brought this decision to the Supreme Court really began in 2017 with a decision in the D.C. Circuit, commonly referred to as Sable Trail. In that case, FERC had issued a Certificate of Public Convenience and Necessity for a couple of pipelines in Florida that were going to be supplying natural gas to natural gas power plants. The D.C. Circuit reversed and remanded the commission, holding that FERC had an obligation at a minimum to quantify and estimate the greenhouse gas emissions that would result when the gas that those pipelines transport to those power plants is combusted and then emitted. Over the years since that decision, the commission, FERC, has wrestled with the consequences of that decision and the extent to which that decision directs and empowers the commission to serve as a sort of climate regulator under the Biden administration, when the commission attempted to, on the basis of Sable Trail and subsequent decisions, impose substantive climate change considerations into its decision making on whether or not to issue certificates of public convenience and necessity. While today's decision, or yesterday's decision, comes from the Surface Transportation Board, it involves a similar set of issues. A rail line in Utah, an 88-mile rail line in Utah, was going to transport crude oil to refineries along the Gulf of Mexico, and the D.C. Circuit vacated that decision for failing to consider the greenhouse gas impact, the global warming significance of the induced oil and gas production in the Uinta Valley in Utah, as well as environmental justice considerations and emissions along the Gulf of Mexico in the refineries to which the crude oil was ultimately destined. So with that set up, Mario, what did the court decide? Can you give us an overview?
So the main, there were two bases for the court's decision here. The first was that, according to Justice Kavanaugh, who wrote the opinion of the court here, and I say of the court because it was an unanimous decision, 8-0 with Gorsuch recusing. Justice Kavanaugh wrote that the D.C. Circuit had failed to offer the deference due to the Surface Transportation Board's, not just in the things that you would normally expect the agency to get deference on, but particularly the STB's determination of what impacts to study, which is a potentially very big deal, right, as we can get to here in our discussion. And the other basis of the court's decision was that there was no need for the agency to study the impacts of projects that are removed in time and space from the project under consideration for the federal action. And that is also a potentially impactful, open to questions about how much impact it will have. I'll say that I wrote an amicus brief in this case with Professor Richard Epstein and Professor James Coleman, we pointed out several things that we can get to here in the discussion about the enforceability of the CEQ regulation that has a bearing on this case, the limits that the Administrative Procedure Act itself imposes on what impacts an agency can be required to study under NEPA. The court's decision in this case, as you mentioned, it was the first consequential NEPA decision. Well, the first consequential NEPA case in 20 years. Whether or not it will prove to be a consequential NEPA decision depends in large part on how lower courts interpret this decision and the language in this decision moving forward. It could turn out to be a consequential decision, but it might not turn out to be a very consequential decision. And in that sense, the decision is of a victory, but not an entirely satisfying victory for those of us who filed amicus briefs in support of petitioner in this case.
Thanks, Mario. So I think the court came to a unanimous decision because I think it seemed clear to the court that this rail line, when the Surface Transportation Board is authorizing a rail line, the effects of refining oil and gas in the Gulf of Mexico are simply not in the wheelhouse of what the Surface Transportation Board is supposed to be doing. It's not the project at hand. Can you give a little insight on what you think courts in the future will do with this project and hand language the time, nearby and time and place language that's in Justice Kavanaugh's opinion.
Well, let me answer the question by starting with Justice Sotomayor's concurrence, because Justice Sotomayor's concurrence focuses on the issue essentially of that you raise with Sable Trail. Hang on one second. Let me find the exact, because the most important sentence in Sotomayor's concurrence is actually in a footnote. I have no idea why it's in a footnote. It should be the pull quote of the entire concurrence. But she basically focused in on the fact that the public convenience and necessity, which is the standard for granting a certificate under the Interstate Commerce Act, that governs the Surface Transportation Board's authorization in this case, does not encompass, as you said, the effects of oil drilling and refining downstream, and does not affect climate impacts, because that's not the purpose of the statute. That's potentially very impactful because, of course, as you well know, sitting at FERC, the Federal Power Act and the Natural Gas Act contain similar language about public convenience and necessity. All these laws date, of course, back to the 1920s, when this was a favorite phrase of Congress empowering these independent commissions, and so now the argument will be for those who want to defend a FERC permit will be that, well, and for those who say that Sable Trail has been in effect reversed by this decision, they will say that public convenience and necessity under the Natural Gas Act, which is the applicable act for FERC's granting of authorizations for natural gas pipelines, similarly does not encompass climate impacts. I mean, that's a question that I would actually pose to you, because under the Natural Gas Act, I think that public convenience and necessity has been held to encompass environmental impacts probably more systematically, I would say. I mean, it's a question that I have is whether certificate of public convenience and necessity under the Natural Gas Act hasn't included environmental considerations in a way that convenience and necessity under the Interstate Commerce Act has not. But if those are held to be sort of equivalent phrases with equivalent scope and don't include climate impacts, then essentially that is going to turn into an important limiting principle on what impacts can be studied in an EIS in connection with a permit under those laws as well.
So in Sable Trail, the FERC certificated pipelines were directly feeding natural gas to the power plants that were then burning the gas that the pipelines transport. And because of under Justice Kavanaugh's separate in time and place standard, does that make Sable Trail distinguishable from Eagle County case here, where the 88-mile rail spur in Utah was separated by the main branch line of the Union Pacific Railway between there and the Gulf of Mexico? Will that be the sort of factual question that future cases will turn on?
They may, right? I mean, there are two questions here. Remember that Justice Sotomayor's concurrence said we don't have to deal with that because the study of these oil and downstream oil and gas production, oil and gas impacts, is beyond the scope of the agency's authority under the Interstate Commerce Act. So, open and shut case. And so I just go back to that will be the threshold question of, are we looking at something that's within the scope of the agency's authority? Then I suppose if we are, I mean, a subsidiary question then is, are these impacts the impacts of a project that's separate in time and space? This language, by the way, about separate in time and space is relevant because it is from the definition of indirect effects under the NEPA regulation of CEQ. And a document which the court does not mention either in the court's opinion or the concurrence, which is interesting in and of itself. And so what you could, this is one respect in which, I mean, the CEQ regulation has now been rescinded, but this is one respect in which you could say that if it hadn't, if the CEQ regulation had not been rescinded, this decision would essentially reverse the CEQ regulation to the extent that the CEQ regulation of NEPA created or purported to create judicially enforceable requirements to study cumulative impacts, to study alternatives outside the agency's jurisdiction, and things like that. So, but I will say, let's just go to the first basis of Kavanaugh's opinion. The first major thing that he says that was somewhat surprising and could be potentially maybe the most impactful part of this case, which is the way that he treats the EIS is as, you know, he starts by saying that the EIS is not separate from the record of decision that triggers NEPA review. And that's important because that means that just because an EIS is sufficient, it is insufficient. It has some, let's say the EIS has some deficiency, it cannot be challenged as an agency action under the Administrative Procedure Act because it is only one, the deficiency in the EIS is only one part of the question of the sufficiency of the agency action itself under the Administrative Procedure Act. And then the standard is going to be, is this something that was required to inform, does the agency's decision have a reasonable explanation such that it can survive arbitrary and capricious review under Section 706 of the APA? And that will entail a question about whether the information was necessary to inform the agency, whether the agency would have changed its mind absent this information. And from there, he makes another step, which is very consequential potentially, which is to say that the level of detail in which an impact has to be studied is a matter left essentially to the agency's discretion by the Administrative Procedure Act. Similarly, what impacts need to be studied is something that courts should give substantial deference to the agency on. And similarly, what alternatives need to be studied under the law is something that courts should defer to agencies on. And that is potentially impactful because, of course, courts have spent 40 years not deferring to agencies on any of that, right? Now that is not a problem necessarily under NEPA. That's a problem of the fact that, you know, as Richard Epstein has argued very convincingly, the Administrative Procedure Act's deference doctrines have all been turned upside down. And so we see many cases in administrative law in which the court will start by saying, of course, under arbitrary and capricious review with respect to an agency's technical or policy judgment, especially on the frontiers of science within an area of the agency's expertise, that's where the courts have to be at their most deferential. And then the next thing they do is like not defer to the agency at all, which is what the D.C. Circuit did in the decision below. Right. It just said we defer to the STB. And then it just said, the STB says that there's no fire hazard here. We disagree. The STB says that that these impacts upstream are not consequential. We disagree.
The classic argument in a lot of these cases is that the courts are not supposed to fly spec environmental documents, but of course the courts, whenever the courts say that, they of course then immediately go on to do just that. Now, yeah, this gets to how much of a sea change this decision might wind up being. Much current NEPA litigation turns on the question of whether or not specific effects are reasonably foreseeable. And that is what much of the litigation is attempting to address, whether the agency left out effects that are that are in fact reasonably foreseeable, but that the agency did not include. Reasonable foreseeability does not really come up much at all in Justice Kavanaugh's opinion. Rather, his decision focuses on the deference question, the standard of review, right? The bedrock principle of judicial review in NEPA cases can be stated in a word: deference. How much of a change do you think that is going to be? Are litigants still going to be arguing over whether or not effects are reasonably foreseeable, or will they be arguing over the extent to which the agencies should be continuing to receive this deference?
Well, let me just take a step back, first of all, and talk about the broader pattern and tendency in the court's jurisprudence on administrative law generally, and what I think that this decision might portend for that general trend. This is a court that, and remember, Justice Kavanaugh is sort of like an administrative law expert, given his time at staff secretary in the Bush administration and then his time on the DC Circuit. He has very strong and very well developed opinions on administrative law. And so it is not surprising that he's taking the lead on this. But just to go back to the Loper-Bright decision, what we see is a court that is starting to sort of say, okay, you know, in these areas, important areas of administrative law, our jurisprudence has like gone off the rails. In Loper-Bright, of course, the decision was, you know, to reverse the Chevron case was, under Chevron, the doctrine was that agencies are, the courts are supposed to defer to agency interpretations of law if there's like some ambiguity in the statute, delegating rulemaking authority. And the court, you know, and that's where after 40 years, the court said, you know what, that's just not right, because the Administrative Procedure Act says that courts shall determine all questions, relevant questions of law. And that's Section 706. And Section 706, you know, has a very sensible allocation of deference according to the respective comparative advantage of agencies and courts. It's the province of courts to say what the law means. That's why Chevron was wrong, and that's why courts should not be deferring to agency interpretations of law. On the other hand, it is the province of agencies to say, it is not the province of courts to say what a technical or fact finding or policy judgment ought to be under a particular law. That is the comparative advantage of agencies. And so in a way, you could see this decision as the other side of the coin of Loper-Bright. And if that is the case, then it could be very consequential, because if now we are deferring to agencies, if the courts are going to be deferring to agencies on what impacts to study, what alternatives to study, and how much detail to study them in, you have potentially very significantly reduced the litigation target area of an environmental impact statement or other elements of NEPA review. So that is very impactful. I would say where reasonable foreseeability runs into this is with respect to the second prong, it seems to me, which is this idea that if an indirect effect, because the court, you know, admits that we still have to study indirect effects under NEPA, and I think that the NEPA has really turned into like a blob compared to what it originally was. Someone said an oak tree from an acorn. I still think that when the law calls for the study of effects, it provides no basis for distinguishing between direct effects and indirect effects. So I still think that under NEPA, you have to study indirect effects, regardless of whether they're direct or indirect. But here,
Justice Kavanaugh gives the example of runoff into a stream as an indirect effect, in his opinion, as something that is likely properly within the scope of an agency's review.
Now, the weird thing about this opinion is that um, that it that it it has a carve out from indirect effects that need to be studied for other projects that are removed in time and place from the agency action or from the project that's under consideration in the agency action at hand. And that strikes me as strange because you can it's easy to imagine downstream impacts that are exactly as foreseeable or unforeseeable as the downstream impacts of a project removed in time and place, except that there's no project. And then presumably under this court's opinion, if it's reasonably foreseeable, you would have to study those impacts. But if there's an intervening project, you wouldn't. And I think that maybe the analogy to tort law proximate causation is doing a little too much work here because because in proximate causation, when what we say breaks the chain of causation under tort law is if there was something between my negligent act and the damage caused by it, where some intervening actor had negligence of its own, then we're going to say that breaks the even if my thing is still a but for causation, we're going to say that it's not the legally relevant cause. It's not proximate. My action did not proximately cause the effect. This has been analogized to the NEPA context, of course, by Justice Thomas's opinion. Since Justice Thomas's opinion in Public Citizen, the last major NEPA case. And so I would just wonder whether that's doing too much work because the case of projects that are removed in time
Do you think there's a distinction between the emissions from the train that is operating on the line, which Kavanaugh suggests is within scope, and that's an indirect effect, the air pollution and the effect that might have on public health, that is separate from the downstream effects of the refining of the oil? That's the but for. I mean, that is the project at hand versus something else, right?
Versus the project versus another project that's removed in time and space.
Yeah. Now, which he distinguishes from things that will happen incidental to the project, which I think he considers to be things like oil and gas production, which is perhaps more nearby in time and place to the rail line. One can imagine these trains are going to be going pretty close to where the production fields actually are, but nevertheless, that does not fall within his definition of nearby in time and place. He gives a few examples of this, right? And he says the agency may draw what it reasonably concludes is a manageable line, one that encompasses the effects of the project at hand, but not the effects of projects separate in time and place. True. A new airport may someday lead to a new stretch of highway, a new pipeline to a new power plant, a new housing development to a new subway stop, but the environmental effects of the project at hand constitute NEPA's textual focus.
So this is where I think that it's really hard to separate the analysis of, since its passage, NEPA has been searching, courts have been searching for some limiting principle on what downstream and upstream impacts need to be studied under NEPA. And one of the arguments that we make in our brief is that the limiting principle is not in NEPA; it's in the Administrative Procedure Act, right? And it is a corollary of the deference doctrines under Section 706 of the Administrative Procedure Act. And I was surprised that the court did not cite to the Administrative Procedure Act, and I'm particularly surprised that the court did not cite to an important piece of dictum in the West Virginia versus EPA, in which the court says that where the agency has no particular expertise on an issue, Congress would presumably not have required them to study it. That's a very important point because under the Administrative Procedure Act, on the arbitrary and capricious side, which is where courts are supposed to defer to agencies' determinations of technical and policy matters, The courts do not defer to an agency that is talking about things that nobody at the agency knows anything about, right? Because if the agency has no particular expertise, if courts defer to agencies within their areas of expertise because agencies are the experts, presumably they do not defer to agencies outside of those areas of expertise, right? And so then the question is, well, so that and of course the agency's expertise is intimately tied to the agency's jurisdiction. No one at STB knows anything about climate impacts. No one at STB has to know anything about climate impacts because STB doesn't do climate policy. And so it should be a very straightforward to say this is where the DC Circuit got it so wrong, that the DC Circuit is not only not deferring to the agency within its areas of jurisdiction and expertise, but then it goes on to say that the agency should have talked about all this stuff that is outside of the agency's jurisdiction and expertise, and which the agency presumably would not wouldn't have gotten any deference on. And not only that, remember that in State Farm, the court says that one basis for an agency action being deemed arbitrary and capricious is if the agency considered factors that Congress did not intend it to consider. And so to me, the question is, does NEPA, when it says study the impacts of this action without any further qualification, can you read that as imposing on the agency an additional scope of review beyond what its jurisdiction and expertise is? And I think that the answer is that the NEPA has to be read consistent with the Administrative Procedure Act, which counsels against so expansive reading.
These D.C. Circuit decisions, Sable Trail, I think, being the prime example, seemed, in my view and Commissioner Danley's view, work an expansion of FERC's substantive authority, that it was the court that was reading the regulatory authority that the commission has as its disposal in an incredibly broad fashion. That's in the amicus brief that my firm filed on behalf of a group of Republican senators. We argued that the D.C. Circuit was reading FERC's and the Surface Transportation Board's Organic Act so broadly as to raise non-delegation and major questions doctrine issues. Now, I suppose that scope of the agency's authority, though, becomes, as you were intimating earlier, that's a question of law on which the agency doesn't necessarily get deference now under Loper-Bright. While at the same time, Justice Kavanaugh is saying that deference should be the touchstone of judicial review under NEPA. How do you see those two things colliding?
Well, actually, Kavanaugh says exactly what you just said, right? Kavanaugh says, of course, it's the province of courts to say what the agency's, what the meaning of a statute is or what the purpose of the statute is. But then he hones in on this point and says, what level of detail is relevant to the agency decision maker under NEPA? What level of detail with respect to the study of environmental impacts under NEPA is relevant to the agency decision maker? That's a technical question. It's a factual question, and it is not the province of courts to say what that is. And so here again, we get to what I think is the real core of this decision, which is it is certainly the case. I mean, I'm very confident that litigants will, that project sponsors and the U.S. government defending a NEPA, defending an agency determination under NEPA, will now be citing to language in this case and making an argument that they really couldn't make as firm grounds before this decision, which is that all of these things, what level of deep, what impacts to study, what alternatives to study, and how much detail to study them in, is a matter that is left to agency discretion, basically. And therefore not reviewable by course. I mean, substantial deference, right, something that, that courts have to give substantial deference to the agencies on. This will, if, I mean, if given the full potential effect of that, it could really significantly reduce the litigation target area of a lot of NEPA reviews.
Yeah, let's hope. I remain a little pessimistic that the courts will continue to read into these agencies' authorities when doing things like oil and gas leasing, latent authorities for the agency to act as a climate regulator. But I suppose we shall see. Should we turn to Q&A perhaps?
Sounds great.
Do we have any questions?
I don't believe we have audience questions. So if you have any final thoughts you want to give, please feel free. Otherwise, we can wrap slightly early.
I'm happy to just jump in with a few final thoughts. It's very interesting to read Justice Sotomayor's concurrence in this case. She seems to think that this is all very simple and is like not, definitely not a big deal. And I mean, I guess if her opinion boils down to anything, it boils down to, you know, this case, as she says at the outset, this decision follows inevitably from our prior cases on this. And I wonder if that's true, because what she is saying is the big difference between this case and the public citizen case, and where I thought the DC Circuit was on strongest ground, was saying that, you know, in the public citizen case, what was at issue was a non-discretionary was a statute that created a non-discretionary obligation on the part of the agency. So the agency had literally no discretion whatsoever in granting, in taking the action that was required under the statute. Once the president authorized the entry of trucks under NAFTA, the agency had to issue safety regulations. So therefore, there was no point in studying the environmental impacts because there was no decision. This language about limited where the agency has limited statutory authority over the impacts really, really was put to the test in this case, because a convenience of certificate of convenience and necessity is arguably the other end of the spectrum from that, right? That is, convenience and necessity is like the broadest possible standard, and agencies consider all kinds of things in determining public convenience and necessity. Finding precedents, there are Supreme Court precedents that have said, well, okay, it's convenience and necessity is broad, but it's not infinite, and it turns on what the purpose of the statute is. Those are important decisions. Chairman Danley has pointed that out. But this is not something that courts have focused on at all. And so she's acting, Sotomayor is writing as if this is clear to everybody. But it's not. It has not been clear to many, many district and appeals courts going back 40 years. And so that's a potentially significant change now that focuses on the scope of the agency's authority given the purpose of the statute. For the first part of the decision, how much effect we're going to give to the deference that the court says is required, how much effect district courts and courts of appeal are going to give to that, I think will be the biggest determinant of what the long-term impact of this decision is.
Yeah. To wrap up, let's turn to what the Trump administration is doing. On the first day of President Trump's second term here, he issued an executive order unleashing American energy, in which he revoked the President Carter's executive order directing CEQ to establish and create the CEQ NEPA reg framework that has provided much of the skeleton for NEPA reviews for the last 40 plus years. And now CEQ is supposed to be leading an effort, coordinating an effort with the individual agencies to promulgate new rules tailored to the specific agency statutory authorities to minimize the scope of the reviews and to move those reviews as quickly as possible. What impact do you think this case is going to have on that effort?
Well, let me take a step back, first of all, and say this raises an issue that could have been the basis of decision, but was not even mentioned in this case, or could have been part of the basis of decision, but was not mentioned in this case, which is what the legal status of the CEQ regulation of NEPA is. So if NEPA contains some implicit rulemaking authority for CEQ, then the rescission of the Carter era executive order that you mentioned would have had essentially no real effect. But if the position of the administration here now implicitly is that NEPA has no rulemaking authority, which of course it does not. This fact somehow escaped everybody's attention for 40 years. I don't know how, but CEQ has no rulemaking. NEPA has no explicit rulemaking authority for CEQ. And therefore, the only basis of the CEQ regulation was this Carter era executive order, which means that the CEQ so-called regulation has the same status as an executive order itself, which means that it's sort of like a process. It's an internal agency guidance kind of a document, like Executive Order 12866, for example. So when the Carter era executive order was rescinded, CEQ came to a determination that said, okay, well, in that case, then if there is no explicit rulemaking authority, then even though the CEQ regulation was adopted on the way in under notice and comment rulemaking under the Administrative Procedure Act, we know that it doesn't have to go through notice and comment rulemaking under the APA on the way out. So we're going to rescind the rule under an interim final rule, which they did. And courts in Idaho and the DC Circuit have, you know, in the meantime said, yeah, the CEQ regulation is not judicially enforceable. Therefore, it has the status of, you know, internal agency guidance under the APA. I would point out, however, that, people talk about is the CEQ regulation binding on agencies. And I would say that conflates two different senses of the word binding, because even though the CEQ regulation should not be judicially enforceable against agencies any more than 12866 regulatory review is enforceable against agencies by private parties, that does not mean that it's not binding as a matter of inherent executive authority under Article 2, under the as a matter of presidential administration. If the president says, or through CEQ says, agencies, you shall do it this and you shall do it in this way, the agencies, executive branch agencies, have to obey that. Not FERC, of course, or an independent agencies for the moment, but executive branch agencies have to obey that. So why does that matter? Because now the part of the Unleashing American Energy executive order, the part of the to-do list that CEQ is in now, is leading a series of interagency working groups on implementation of NEPA regulations in accordance with the policy of the executive order. To give a quick answer to your question, so I would say, first of all, that CEQ will hopefully be making use of its presidential directive authority to the maximum extent possible to be as prescriptive as possible about how the agencies are supposed to implement NEPA. And in that connection, I hope that CEQ will solve several problems. One is sort of the ambiguities in the Fiscal Responsibility Act amendments to NEPA, which raise questions of their own that we didn't get to, that I think agencies need guidance on. And CEQ has an opportunity now to make maximum use of this opinion by saying that agencies shall treat in their regulations, shall incorporate the principle from this decision that they can expect close to full deference on what alternatives to study, what impacts to study, and how much detail to study them in. And therefore, CEQ is in a position to prescribe what impacts to study, what alternatives to study, and how much detail they can study them in.
So, I suppose one final question for you before we'll wrap this up. The NEPA regulations provided a vocabulary, provided concepts that were the subject of much judicial review over the decades. Concepts like cumulative impacts, connected actions, and the like. To what extent do you think courts will still look to some of those legacy concepts that were in the now rescinded regulations as they review whether or not, even under this highly deferential standard, the agencies are meeting their APA obligations?
Yeah, well, it's very easy to imagine, isn't it, that courts will just, that this will be just a speed bump, and that courts will just say, well, you know, so what impacts is the agency supposed to study here? Well, our courts have said, our decisions have said that they have to study cumulative impacts. And of course, those decisions were saying cumulative impacts because when they said cumulative impacts, they were citing to the now rescinded CEQ regulation of NEPA. But now they could say, well, this is part of the rule of decision and it's part of our jurisprudence. So we're going to just continue to require cumulative impacts because according to our cases, that's part of the impacts that need to be studied by the agency. There's a version of, and there's a related problem, which we are going to encounter also in the case in court interpretations under Chevron, that's referred to as the Chevron donut hole, which is that when the Supreme Court decided Loper-Bright, when the Supreme Court decided Loper-Bright, it said, of course, you know, we're not overturning 50 years of cases decided on the basis of Chevron. We're just saying that moving forward, we're not going to defer to agency interpretations of law. Yeah. And so to that extent, you know, if the prior precedent is still valid under a decision like this, then courts will continue to behave as if these concepts created out of thin air by the CEQ regulation are still.
I think that's right. And I'll just conclude by saying it seems very clear whether or not his opinion could have been crisper and clearer in some respects. Justice Kavanaugh seems like he was emphatic in attempting to convey to the lower courts that they have been making a real mess of things, turning this acorn into an oak tree, obstructing projects, obstructing any effort to develop things here in the United States, and that the courts basically the big picture message is, hey, lower courts, you need to get out of the way. It seems clear that that is the message he is trying to send. I think whether or not that ultimately bears fruit will depend on whether or not it's another 20 years before we get our next landmark NEPA case. So I guess on that, we'll have to stay tuned.
Well, I will chime in and just thank you both for joining us today. We really appreciate you taking the section of your afternoons and sharing your expertise and insight. Thanks also to our audience for joining and participating. Welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about other upcoming virtual events. With that, we can wrap up a couple of minutes early, give everyone back a section of their days, and be adjourned. Thanks again.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.